We've been this term going through John's Gospel, looking at some of the different encounters Jesus had with different people. I hope you're enjoying it. I love the opportunity just to spend time looking at Jesus. If you have been enjoying it, there's just something else I wanted to plug, particularly if you're kind of new to the Christian faith and wanting to know more about Christianity and particularly about Jesus. It's a short course we're going to run after half term called Face to Face with Jesus. It's looking at John's Gospel again, but particularly looking at the signs in John's Gospel and what they tell us, the miracles, what they tell us about Jesus and kind of how we can know him for ourselves. So if you'd like to know more about Jesus, really encourage you to think about that course. There are flyers about it at the back. If you'd like to know more, do speak to me. Okay. So what about this encounter today? I've given it the title, The Woman Caught in Adultery. But actually, this encounter is a little unusual, and it's a little bit shocking. It's unusual because most people sought Jesus out. Most of the encounters we've read about are people like Nicodemus that came looking for Jesus. And actually, this woman doesn't come looking for Jesus. She's forcibly brought to Jesus by these men. It's also interesting because actually I find myself asking the question, how much is this encounter about Jesus and the woman, and how much is the encounter about Jesus and the Pharisees and the scribes? And I think that's important. But for me, the most shocking thing about it is the way that she's just completely dehumanized. We don't even know her name. She's the woman caught in adultery. Actually, the people that bring her to Jesus aren't concerned about her well-being. They're wanting to use her as bait in a trap. Yet for her, the consequences are huge. Accused of adultery, she faces a potential death penalty. So it's a shocking encounter. It's not a comfortable encounter. And it leads to a question for me. And can we have the next slide up? Actually, is this encounter about sex? You know, she was caught in adultery. Or is it about religion? She's brought to Jesus by the religious leaders. Actually, I think it's more about religion than it is about sex. The sex is almost incidental. Although it's interesting, isn't it, that actually sex and religion aren't always happy bedfellows. Well, I'm glad that amused you, Jill. You can sit and snigger the rest of the way. And you could explain to Hannah later why you're giggling. That's even better. Never mind. Okay, so let's jump on again. Religion. Can I have the next slide? Thanks. Just for a moment, ponder it. Are you religious? Yeah. Are you a religious person? I think in this encounter, we see the difference between good religion and bad religion, between law and grace. And I find this question about whether we're religious or not an interesting one. I really don't like religion. And I know I'm a vicar. And you probably get a few of the clues, the fact that I don't wear robes and dog collars and all that sort of stuff. I find myself profoundly uncomfortable with religion per se. And years ago, if people had said to me, you're religious, you know, I would have said to them, no, I'm not, because Christianity isn't a religion. It's about a relationship with Jesus Christ. And I would still stand by that. The heart of Christianity is about God sending his son so we could know what God is like. So we could know not just what God is like, but we could know God and we could have a relationship with him. It's about a relationship. But actually, it's still also about religion, even though I might not want it to be about religion. If we look at a definition of religion, can we have the next slide? It's the belief in and the worship of a superhuman controlling power, especially a personal God. Goes back to that relationship thing or not, doesn't it? So if we believe and if we worship God, then that's religion and that's being religious whether we like it or not. And I kind of, you know, I've always kind of felt like I'd like to do church without religion. But actually, if you believe in God and you practice your faith, then you're being religious. There's no way of avoiding it. So the question is, it's not whether we are religious or not. It's actually what sort of religion we practice. Is it good religion or is it bad religion? Is it informed by love or hate, by law or by grace? And that's kind of scary, isn't it, really? You know, what, you know, where do we fall in that? This week, Carol and I, visited the Tate Modern. I think, to be honest, we were a little bit surprised that we both liked it. Kind of, I have this bad habit of dragging Carol around galleries and making her look at kind of art exhibitions. And most of the time, it's the source of a certain amount of frustration. Actually, for once, we both enjoyed it. And for a variety of different reasons, we saw some amazing stuff there. But for me, one of the most powerful things were some photographs. And if you know me and you know I'm into photography, perhaps that won't surprise you. Normally when I'm drawn to photographs, I'm drawn to them because they move me, frequently because they're beautiful. But this wasn't about beauty. It was actually about brutal reality, if you like. The photographer was an Iranian photographer called, and I'm probably going to pronounce it wrong, Kaveh Golstan. He was an Iranian photojournalist who worked in Iran from right of the, you know, going back to the time of the Shah, and he was there right the way through the revolution. He was there throughout the time that Iran was ruled by the Ayatollah Khomeini. I can't even pronounce it, Khomeini. He photographed him getting off the plane, and he photographed his funeral cortege. And Kaveh died shortly after that, blown up by a landmine in his native Iran. But the photographs that we saw were of a place called Sharia Noor. And Sharia Noor was the red light district in Tehran. And it had a long history of being the red light district, the places where the working women were, the prostitutes were, in Tehran. It had been there before the Shah, as a kind of a community. When the Shah started ruling Iran, and he wasn't, you know, ruling it for that long, it was enclosed, and it became known as the Citadel. And calling it a citadel makes it kind of sound positive, doesn't it? Actually, a better word would be ghetto. And the photographer had gone in there and photographed this community over a long period of time. And the display was predominantly of photographs, portraits of the prostitutes. There's nothing gratuitous about them. There's one there. It just showed ordinary women, frequently downtrodden, struggling to survive in the most difficult of circumstances. And if their life was difficult under the Shah, I don't know how you explain it or express it really, because there aren't words. Obviously, prostitution, I said religion and sex isn't a happy bedfellow. Prostitution and radical Islam is not a good combination. And so when the revolution took place, Sharia Noor was burnt to the ground. And kind of, I Googled it a lot since because it kind of, it gripped me in a horrifying sort of way, trying to make sense of what happened. And all the implications seem to be that actually many of the 1,500 prostitutes, something like 10,000 people lived in that community with their children and the people that looked after the children while the girls were working. But 1,500 prostitutes, actually most of them didn't survive the burning of Sharon Orr. And then there are records on display in the Tate of those that did. And the records are there because several of them were executed for their crimes, the crime of being a prostitute. As I said, I was close to tears looking at it. And it's just one of those occasions when it's just so hard to as I was saying, when you look at something like that, it's incomprehensible. It's incomprehensible that, and I'm using the words intentionally, that men can do that. Not just people can do that, but men can do that. Man's inhumanity to man. And I know it isn't just men, but actually, as in our reading, it's interesting, it's the women that suffer. There's no mention made, you know, in that exhibit of the men that actually kind of took advantage of those women and their prostitution and kind of serviced that industry. They wouldn't have been there if men didn't want to sleep with them. And all done in the name of religion. And we live in an age when there are too many examples of bad religion. And it would be lovely to limit that to one particular type of religion. But actually, I don't think there are any exceptions. It feels like every religion actually has the potential to be bad religion, or every faith, whether it's ISIS as Muslims, or whether it's the Buddhist in Myanmar oppressing the Muslim Rohingya, or whether actually in the Democratic African Republic, there actually is predominantly Christians oppressing Muslims. No religion, no faith is kind of exempt from that potential to be bad religion. And this is a massive issue. It's a massive issue for the world in which we live because it continues in our lifetime. And it was happening 2,000 years ago in Jesus' time. There's a danger, though, that when we talk about it, it can feel like it's a million miles away from the reality of our lives. And so what I want to do is kind of bring that challenge closer to home into our lives too. So let's look at the passage. Just first the context of what's going on here. This is the end of the Feast of the Tabernacles. There are some real oddities about this passage. You know, some people suggest it's not in the original. It appears actually possibly to come from Luke and been inserted there because of where it happens. But it appears to be right at the end of the Feast of the Tabernacles. And if you read the previous chapter, you kind of read about the culmination of that feast. It was a 7-day feast with an optional 8-day extra. And so kind of what happens in the previous chapter is all about the first 7 days. This is the kind of optional extra when people, it's a bit like if you kind of go to somewhere like New Wine and you stay in camp on an extra day and you kind of make an extra party of it or something like that. It's like they've continued with the feast and the celebration the next day, which is the Sabbath day. But on the last formal day of this feast, the 7th day of the feast, Jesus had stood up and he had spoken to the crowd. And it says in verse 37 of the previous chapter, on the last and the greatest day of the festival, Jesus stood up and said in a loud voice, "Let anyone thirsty come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the scriptures have said, rivers of living water will flow from within them. And by this he meant the Spirit, from whom those who believed in him were later to receive. Up to that time, the Spirit had not been given, since Jesus had not yet been glorified. Let me just build a little bit of a picture of this feast. That one of the highlights in this feast would have been the priests taking pitchers of water and pouring it out into a hole in the temple where it would have flowed out of the temple and out towards the city wall. And it was kind of a prophetic act. They were looking forward to a day when God's presence and God's life would flow from the temple to touch the whole world. And kind of they were reenacting, if you like, the prophecy in Ezekiel about the river that flows from God's presence, from the temple, out into the desert and brings life wherever it goes. And so kind of this whole Feast of the Tabernacles, the culmination of it was looking to God for a day when God would come and his presence wouldn't be contained in the temple anymore, when it would flow out and it would change the whole world and it would change everyone's lives. And the middle of that expectation and of that looking forward, Jesus stands up and says, if anyone believes in me, then streams of living water are going to flow out, not out of the temple. They're going to flow out of me. I'm the one that brings life. I'm the one that's going to fulfill people's thirst for meaning. All of that hope is found in me. And kind of that's what's happened literally the day before this encounter in the temple. And if you kind of read on in the previous chapter, you will find that this is incredibly divisive. Some people go, wow, yes, he must be a prophet, or maybe he's the Christ. They hear it and they believe it and they want it. But for everyone that responds positively, there are others that are muttering, who's he to say this? This is blasphemous. This is wrong. And it antagonizes the Jewish rulers that are already against him. And it kind of says from that moment on, they're starting to look for ways to trick him and trap him and shut him up. And that's the setting. So this woman being brought to Jesus in the temple is all about trying to trap Jesus. Actually, it's not about the woman at all. She's the bait in the trap. She's fodder for them trying to catch Jesus out. And she's the unfortunate person that gets caught up in all of this. And so the setting then for what happens is the Sabbath day. The formal part of the festival is finished. The optional extra day, people can stay for the Sabbath, is going on. And that's when our reading takes place. Jesus is in the temple courts and the teachers of the law and the Pharisees bring this poor, unfortunate woman to him. They inform him that she's been caught in the act of adultery. And then they remind him of what the law, and it's in Leviticus and it's in Deuteronomy. Obviously, adultery is one of the Ten Commandments that is explicitly forgiven. This is at the heart of the Jewish law. And they remind him that the Jewish law prescribes the death penalty for this. And they say, what do you say? And it's interesting, you know, in the first instance, they're correct. You know, that's what's prescribed by the law, death for adultery, although not necessarily stoning. But why are they asking? Are they asking because they care about the question? Or they want to find an answer? Are they asking because they want to do what's right in what is clearly a difficult legal situation? Actually, I don't think they're asking for either of those reasons. They're only asking the question because they want to catch Jesus out. It's an elaborate trap, And it's the consequence of what's happened the day before when Jesus has stood up and made this incredible claim. And kind of in our reading, John's quite clear about it. He says they were using this question as a trap. And actually it's quite a clever trap. Kind of think about it for a moment. If Jesus says, no, don't stone her, the consequence would be, actually it would make Jesus a heretic. It would suggest that he doesn't take the law seriously. And they would be able to undermine him that way. If Jesus says, yes, stone her, it will change everyone's perception of Jesus. Because if you look at Jesus in the Gospels, one of the things that comes through again and again is actually Jesus is someone that is moved by compassion in how he deals with people. His heart is broken for people that are hurting. And if he responds as the law says, kind of that strips all of his compassion away from him. The other lovely little thing is it also potentially puts him at loggerheads with the Romans. Since AD 6, the Romans have been running the country and the Jews technically weren't allowed to stone or execute anyone. So if he says, yes, execute, then potentially he's breaking Roman law as well because they've lost the power to do that. You can almost hear the glee in the scribes and the Pharisees. You know, they think they've got him caught. With what they're going to do. And it's interesting, isn't it? That in trying to trap Jesus because they disagree with Jesus, they themselves have become monsters. And the person that's caught up in the middle of this, the woman, what about her? Well, it seems to me they had no concern for the woman at all. Just look at how she's treated. This takes place close to dawn. So it's unlikely that she's just been caught. It probably was something that happened the night before. So what does that mean? Well, she's probably been thrown into a prison cell for the night, left there to agonize over what's going to happen next, facing all sorts of uncertainty and wondering what's happening in her life. If she has done something wrong, then you would have expected some sort of due process of law. A private trial where kind of people's dignity might be protected. But no, she's dragged into the temple. And actually, we don't know exactly what part of the temple Jesus is in. She could have, you know, a lot of it was male only. She could have been just dragged before a whole load of blokes to be humiliated and victimized in this sort of way. It couldn't have been more degrading or terrifying. And actually, it's chauvinistic, isn't it? Am I wrong in that? You can hear it in the language of the scribes and the Pharisees. Such women. But actually, the law condemns men and women for adultery. Where's the man? It's kind of back to that place of how often it's the woman that suffers in this situation. It's everything that's wrong about religion. It's hypocritical. It points at others' faults. And to be honest, it's too close, isn't it, to how people view religion today and why people are uncomfortable religion and reject religion. You know, religious people are killjoys. They point out other people's faults. They make people feel condemned. And that's what's going on in this woman's life, isn't it? They're making her feel condemned. She's just the poor person that's caught up in their elaborate trap. It's an awful way to behave. And it's so far removed from what Jesus came to establish. But actually, how does it help us bring this whole issue home into our lives? You know, it's 2,000 years ago. It could be a million years ago. It's as many miles away. It could be a million miles away from the reality of our lives. But actually, I just wonder if the human heart is so different here and now as it was there and then. Let's kind of take this and apply it to the world of social media. This is a good test for you. Has anyone heard of someone called Justin Sacco? Is that a name that rings Any bells? Clearly not. Okay. She became infamous a few years ago, 2013, on social media, on Twitter in particular. She became infamous for what actually was an extremely racist tweet. She was a PR communications executive for a large industry company in America. But actually, really, she was a complete nobody. She had 170 followers on her Twitter account. Actually, it's 20 more than mine, so I'm even more of a nobody, but never mind. In 2013, she was going to Africa, to South Africa, for her holidays. And sitting en route at Heathrow Airport, she thought she would put a funny comment in her Twitter feed. And she tweeted something that was grossly offensive. Going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS, just kidding, I'm white. And it was incredibly offensive, as you can imagine. She monitored her phone up until getting on the plane, kind of hoped that some of her friends would respond to her kind of somewhat dubious humour. I don't think she'd even thought what she was saying was racist. I don't know how you could not realise that. And when she got on the plane, no one had noticed her Twitter feed. She got on the plane, and for 11 hours, she went to sleep. And she arrived in South Africa to discover that in 11 hours, her whole life had completely unravelled. As she turned on her phone, the first text was from a childhood friend. It said, "So sorry to hear what's happened." And she kind of thought, what's happened? I'm going on holiday to Africa. What's to be sorry about? This is great. And then there was a message on her answering machine from her best friend. "Ring me. You must speak to me immediately." And when she spoke to her friend, she said, "You've just become the number one thing on Twitter." While she was on the flight, one of the people, of the 170 on her Twitter feed, had forwarded her Twitter to a journalist who had retweeted her tweet with a few extra comments to his 15,000 followers. And her tweet had gone viral. She had become, in 11 hours, the number one trend on Twitter. And some of those responses, rightly, challenged her sensitivity and her attitudes. And to be honest, they needed challenging, didn't they? What she said was completely out of order. Others embarked on what could best be described as public shaming. And there are so many different headlines, but they were going to really drag her through the dirt for what she said. One of the tweets that kind of started to spread like wildfire, and there were many about her. You know, it wasn't just her tweet that got tweeted; it was tweets about her that got retweeted, and the whole thing just kind of escalated. Was, "Has Justin landed yet?" And people were saying, "I so want someone to get a picture of her as she lands." And can you believe it? People got themselves to the airport in South Africa to photograph her as she looked at her phone and started to see this whole lot. And those pictures got tweeted. Others called for her to lose her job. And one of the tweets on there was from her firm, basically denying all knowledge of her, and she was sacked within a month. Others were just pure hate. And it's interesting because they're the sort of things that are becoming common, actually, on social media today. People wanted her to be attacked. People wanted her to be raped. People wanted her to catch AIDS. People wanted her to die. And it's interesting. Do you remember the court case challenging the EU kind of referendum result that was brought by that lady businesswoman? You know, that's the sort of tweets that she got for challenging that. Interesting. A year later, her life was still in tatters. No job, in her opinion, unable to, as a single person, to enter into a relationship. Because what do people do when they kind of start dating someone? They Google them. And if you Google her, Google her, go home and Google her. It's pretty horrific. Her whole life was torn to shreds. There's some big questions here, aren't there? Was she right to say what she said? Categorically, no. What she did was wrong. What she said was wrong. It was grossly offensive. But did she deserve what happened to her? I don't think so. The journalist who tweeted it was asked, what did it feel like to break this story? And his comment was, it was delicious. He thrived on the pleasure of breaking it. And he was explicit. It was delicious to bring down a high-ranking PR executive. He had a thing against them. He disagreed with them. And so that made it right for him to bring that person down. And I just think it's interesting for both Justin Sacco and for the woman caught in adultery, what is going on here is it's akin to what happened when people used to be put in the stocks. The punishment is almost as much about public shaming as it is about justice. And it feeds something in human nature that's not very nice. And if I can put a finger on it, is there is something in human nature that feels better, that makes us feel better about other people's kind of misfortunes. To some degree, it happens every Sunday here in church when we compare whose team has done well in the football. Mine didn't this weekend. Someone else's team can sometimes give you as much pleasure losing as your team winning. And that's kind of fine, isn't it? Because it's not serious. But actually, sometimes it feels like people get as much pleasure out of other people's pain when they disagree with them as they do about their own success. What does it say about our lives? It feeds something that's wrong about human nature. It's the attitude of the scribes and the Pharisees, and it's the attitude of the Twitter shamers that's shocking. And I think the difference in good and bad religion can be summed up in this. And I think this comes from someone called John Ronson. Good religion values people over ideologies. Bad religion values ideologies over people. The journalist thought it was delicious because his ideology had won over another ideology and he didn't care about the personal trauma caught up in it. The Pharisees were rubbing their hands with glee because they thought that their ideology was going to triumph over Jesus' ideology, and they did not give a toss for the poor woman that was caught up in the mixture of what they were trying to do. And it's that latter that we see at work here in the scriptures and on Twitter. Bad religion valuing ideology over people. People being secondary. And I'm just really aware that the kids are queuing up at the door. So I'm just going to try and go a real tailspin into closing this. I think it's a real warning in this. We need to be careful when we speak out on issues that we don't fall into the same trap. Carol and I stayed a couple of nights in London and we had London News on. One of the big things on local London News at the moment is about people of faith groups protesting outside abortion clinics. And it seems to me it's another example of ideologies being put above human beings. And you may disagree with me on that one. This isn't how Jesus responds. He stops. He writes. There's a lesson in that. Think before we speak. We don't know what he writes, and I haven't got time to go into what that might be. And then he speaks, and he speaks with great wisdom. Whoever's without sin, let them throw the first stone. And Jesus' words reveal their hearts. And it's interesting that it's the older ones that leave first. The older we get, the more we become aware of our own feelings. And then Jesus puts into practice what he had said the day before when he stood up in the temple. He turns around and says to her, "Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more." He offers a new life and a fresh start when others want to use her as a bait in a trap and abuse her and see her as worthless. That's good religion. Let's pray. Lord, just thank you that you're the one that sees our hearts. And Lord, sometimes we don't look like looking at them ourselves. Thank you that you offer life and a fresh start, no matter how broken we are. Amen.